40 years later, following the restoration of the Jewish, Hasmonean, monarchy, John Hyrcanus destroyed the Samaritan temple. The Jews and Samaritans lived side by side in a relationship of mutual hatred and distrust for many centuries. The pious talk of the present-day Likud government of Israel about reclaiming the sacred land of Samaria on the West Bank is an historical travesty. In 332 BC, Alexander the Great burst upon the world scene, and in his short life, conquered the entire Persian Empire. Upon Alexander's death, the empire was divided among his senior generals. Ptolemy became ruler of Egypt, and its capital city of Alexandria attracted large numbers of Jews, who prospered under the privileges extended to them by him. Over the years, the Jewish community grew powerful, and at one time comprised almost 40% of the population of Alexandria, the second largest city in the Mediterranean world. In the case of Palestine, however, this favorable situation came to an end with the triumph of Antiochus of Syria over the Ptolemaean armies, and in 201 BC Judah came under the control of the Seleucids. The Seleucid dynasty, also founded by one of Alexander's generals, attempted to impose Greek customs and religious practices upon the Jews to whom Hellenism was anathema. The Jews of Palestine revolted under the famous leader Judas Maccabeus, who conducted a brilliant guerrilla campaign against the Syrians. Judas reconquered Jerusalem and reconsecrated the temple in 165 BC, an event celebrated today as a new cap. Thus began the Jewish, Hasmonean, dynasty of the Maccabees. The Jewish kingdom restored the first years of the Jewish kingdom under the Maccabees, were spiritually rich and materially prosperous. Then came a tragic turn in the fate of Judah. This is described in the following passage from Abram Sacher's A History of the Jews referred to earlier. Material prosperity continued under John Hyrcanus, son of Simon Maccabeus, who succeeded to the headship of the state when Simon, his father, was treacherously assassinated. Perhaps there was now too much prosperity. Hyrcanus' head was turned by ambitions to play a role in the Eastern Mediterranean world. He created a mercenary army, with which he proceeded to carve out an empire. He subjugated the Samaritans, and destroyed their temple. He gave Israel's ancient enemies, the Edomites, the alternative of exile or conversion to Judaism. It was a sorry commentary upon the perverseness of human nature, that Hyrcanus was already spreading his faith by the point of the sword, although he was only one generation removed from those who had poured out life and fortune for religious freedom. His son, Aristobulus, continued and improved upon his example. He pushed his conquests up through Galilee and ultimately crowned himself king. He reintroduced the dreadful Oriental custom of destroying the members of his family who could become a threat to the security of his throne. Meantime, a formidable party had developed that vigorously opposed the policy of the rulers and their abandonment of Hasmonean idealism. The Pharisees were opposed by the Sadducees, who supported the royal policy of imperialism. Their opposition reached the point of civil war in the reign of Alexander Janadius, who succeeded his brother, Aristobulus. Janadius inaugurated a persecution in which 6,000 Pharisees lost their lives. Sacher describes the state of anarchy in Judah in these words: "For 6 years the civil strife continued. Janadius was merciless when opposed. At one time 800 rebels who had held a fortress against him were crucified, and the throats of their wives and children were cut before their dying eyes. 8,000 others were driven into Egyptian exile. Even in the worst days of the Israelite monarchy thereafter the death of Janadius, his wife, Alexandra, who succeeded to the throne, reversed his policy, and favored the Pharisees. For a moment there was peace in Judah. The exiles returned, foreign wars ceased, and the old faith was practiced without hindrance. But the Pharisees had been too sorely outraged to allow their enemies to escape without punishment. Firm in their belief that their anchor was virtue, they instituted a series of persecutions and judicial murders which opened the Roman general Pompey was creating an empire in the east for the new mistress of the Mediterranean, and looked greedily upon the fortresses of southwestern Asia. Both warring factions in Judea appealed to him in 64 BC to judge between them, and after a show of deliberation he supported Aristobulus, and bade his rival begone. He sent to Rome the magnificent golden vine which the grateful Aristobulus sent. Next year the Pharisees begged Pompey to abolish the kingship altogether, take control of the country, and remove the curse of dynastic war. Pompey acted with alacrity, and sent his legions to take over the thus the end of the Jewish kingdom of Judah came with an invitation to the Romans to take over Jerusalem and Judea. Sacha concludes this sad chapter with the following observation. Freedom was again crushed, because the Jews had not learned how to use it. The selfishness of the ruling houses and the strife of political and religious factions exhausted the strength of the state. A curse seemed to lie on the Jews which prevented them from reaching the highest levels of moral power, except when they were hammered and beaten by a quarter of a century after Rome assumed control over Judea, the state was still in turmoil. The people suffered from the interminable feuds of the Hasmonean princes but also from the civil strife and upheaval in Rome. It was during this period that Herod supplanted the declining Hasmonean dynasty. Herod turned out to be one of the ablest rulers in Jewish history, and brought peace to Judah. His reign was a genuine Augustan age for Palestine. He respected the scruples of the Pharisees, and, as far as he was able, did not allow any offense of statues into Jerusalem and even omitted his own image from the coinage. He built a magnificent temple, far more beautiful than the already legendary Temple of Solomon. Upon the death of Herod, the last phase of stable Jewish rule effectively ended. Instead, there followed a period of great and rising tension, the reasons for which were not clear to the Romans. Rome's method of governing the empire was considered liberal for the times. Certainly this was the view of the 6 million or more Jews in the diaspora, who were treated as a special people accorded many privileges not allowed any other. They had their own courts and system of taxation, and were the only people not required to offer sacrifices to the emperor, or recognize his divinity. The Roman legions were not allowed to enter Jerusalem with their eagle standards for fear of giving offense to the Jews who prohibited graven images. Most of the Jews in Palestine did not see Romans as oppressors or enemies of their religion. However, a substantial minority of zealots and other extreme militants in Palestine were unreconciled to the Romans' rule, and from time to time committed violent acts of defiance. Ultimately, the Romans found the Jews to be ungovernable, even under their own rulers, and the people too turbulent to handle without direct Roman supervision. A procurator was therefore placed in control, responsible directly to the emperor. Still, the country was rife with rebellion. There were three different factions in the Jewish population, opposed to the Romans, but bitter enemies of each other. The Roman wars began when the fortress at Macedon, which was occupied by a Roman garrison, was captured by one group of rebels and the Roman soldiers, at the fortress Antonia, offered to surrender, and be allowed to leave the country. The terms were accepted by the Jews, but as soon as the Romans had laid down their arms they were savagely. The tragic story of the siege and destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman for the purpose of this book Sacha's account is referred to here. The city was magnificently fortified, protected externally by a triple circle of walls, and internally by numerous towers and defenses. And the Jews, fired by holy zeal, were determined not to give in to the Romans, while the breath of life remained in them. Titus implored the city to surrender, but the Roman emissaries were killed. Courage and defiance went for naught, however, in the face of the cursed factional strife which cropped up again. Even in the most critical, three factions fought each other, divided by temperament, by personal animosities, by disputes over war methods. One held the upper tower, one the lower, and the other the temple area in between. None cooperated with another, riots and assassinations were frequent, while the most powerful legions in the world pounded at the gates. The zealots refused any Roman offers of truce or surrender. They firmly believed that God would not let Jerusalem fall. Finally, in AD 1970, after incredible suffering, Jerusalem was captured and destroyed. Almost as the great Jewish historian general, Josephus, in his account The Jewish War, which was written to show the total impossibility that the war against Rome could have succeeded, blames the war and the disaster on the Josephus, wrote that because of their actions, out of all the cities under Roman rule it was the lot of ours, Jerusalem, to attain the highest felicity. For almost half a century after the destruction of Jerusalem, the Jews lived at peace, enjoying equal political rights with the non-Jewish subjects of Rome, and enjoying the general prosperity of the times. As Satcher describes it, the Jews gradually adjusted themselves to the tragedy that had come upon them. The fall of the temple and the